Fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip.
How many roads must a man walk down before you call him a man? Yes, and how many seas must a white dove see before she sleeps in the sand? Yes, and how many times must the cannonballs fly before they're forever banned? The answer, my friend, is a blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind.
I'm Glenn Moberg, and today on Route 51, we bring you a very special program as we feature a conversation with a young man from Africa with an amazing story of perseverance, hard work, redemption, and a passion for science. William Kamkwamba, the boy who harvested the wind, which is the title of his best-selling autobiography. Growing up in the back country of Malawi, Africa, he survived famine, disease, poverty, and political oppression and had to drop out of school. So he decided to educate himself, going to a small village library and reading books, including an American textbook on the physics of energy. William Kamkwamba, while still a teenager, taught himself about electricity, alternating and direct current, and electromagnetic induction. And then he was seized with a dream. He would build a windmill to bring electricity and irrigation to his impoverished village. With no tools and salvaged parts from a junkyard, he not only built it, he made it work. What followed was international fame, the support of venture capitalists, a book contract, and admission to Dartmouth. William Kamkwamba was in central Wisconsin this week through the Walk in Their Shoes program. He visited with school kids and adults in Edgar, Wausau, and Stevens Point. We're going to listen to William Kamkwamba's story in his own words and then talk about it with Colin Hansen, the Edgar Elementary School teacher who brought him here, and also Romy Wagner, a Wausau man who has helped the Maasai tribe in Kenya build their own generator and windmill-driven wells. Now, we'll be taking your phone calls in that part of the program, but first, the boy who harvested the wind, William Kamkwamba, in his own words. We begin our conversation with his recollections of growing up in Malawi with his family and his father.
My dad, in his young age, in his early 20s, he used like to travel around and to enjoy himself, like drinking, and sometimes also like involved in fightings, and then later on, he changed when he met my mother, and then he started farming. So he moved back to the village where his brother was living, and he started growing crops, growing corn, and also growing tobacco at that time.
Corn, tobacco, you grow anything else on the farm?
Yeah, and also some sweet potato, Irish potato, and beans. Those were some of the crops that we are growing.
And pumpkins?
Oh, yeah, even the pumpkins. Yeah, I forgot that.
What was your house like on the farm?
So it was like a small house in the farm, which had like three bedrooms and a sitting room.
And no plumbing, no electricity?
No electricity, no water. It's just like a house. You have like outhouse, and also you have the kitchen outside the house.
The kitchen was outside the house?
Outside the house.
And what kinds of food did you eat? Of course, everything that you grew, but what else?
So most of the food that we eat on Sima, it's made out of like corn flour. So you grind for corn, and then you use the flour to make the food. It's kind of like mashed potato, but it's not really like mashed potato, but it's the same form of mashed potato. Mm-hmm. And you eat that together with it. Vegetables, beef, or chicken, if you have money to buy it. So
and goat meat.
And goat meat, yeah.
Now you write about your grandfather. He was a great hunter. Tell me a little bit about him.
Yeah, so my grandfather used like to hunt a lot. He used to make his own hunting tools, like bow and arrows and spears. He used to make. They would go out hunting different types of animals. Ideas and the anthropes, but as the times goes by, I think as more people coming into the area, starting mm-hmm. like farming, cutting down the trees, the animals have to move further and further away. So
Malawi changed quite a bit from the time he was a young man to the time you were a young man. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. Hearing the story from him, his time when he was a young man, you couldn't see far away because of the trees in between. So you'd be blocked by the trees. But right now you can pretty much see like five miles away that all this.
The
like
trees have been cut down.
The trees have cut down, yeah.
Now they were cut down by the big tobacco estates primarily?
Yeah, that's primarily by the big tobacco estates company. And also people are clearing some of the land to start growing crops on mm-hmm. them. So
cutting down the forest like that, you write that that added to the impoverishment of your people.
Yeah, in that way that my grandpa used to hunt, but now because the forest has been cut down, then he cannot hunt anymore. So mm-hmm. that's one of the part of the consequences of that, of cutting down the trees. And also because there's no enough trees to hold the soil together. So when it rains, mm-hmm. it can wash away all the nutrients in the soil. So if you're a farmer, then it's also like hard, difficult on you.
You know, we had the same problem in America in the 1930s when they had a great drought and there was very poor soil conservation practices and there were great windstorms. They called it the Dust Bowl that just blew away all of the soil. In America, we eventually learned, at least we hope we learned about conservation. Are people trying to learn about conservation now in Malawi so that they can replenish the soil and maybe plant trees in strategic places so you can at least have better farmland?
Yeah, there have been like some programs that people are working on trying to start like growing the forest back and also to preserve the land. So there's like lots of programs. We have National Tree Planting Day mm-hmm. where pretty much a lot of people are being like encouraged to plant some trees, but also trying to start like using some compost manure so mm-hmm. that they can be able to solve some of the problems that people are facing.
Now, you lived in a world where people believed in magic, right? And not always good magic. Can you tell me the story about the gumballs?
Oh, so it's when I was a child like this, like I was like hearing all kind of stuff about magic. So I was most of the time, I was afraid. And the like one day, one of my friends, they gave me like chewing gum. They said that they found it by the Lord, and then they gave some to it. And it turns out, I think somebody who was like a trader, I think he dropped it and then they took it instead of like giving back to him. And he was so mad. He was like, oh, I'm going to use magic to find out who got it. But
and then put a curse on you, right?
Yeah. So most of the time, I think I was really afraid of like magic because I don't know, is it like just like imagination or what? So.
Well, with this one story, you write that your dad found the man who lost the bag of gum, and he paid him for the entire value of the bag of gum, and that would have taken the curse off of you.
Yeah.
You must have been really relieved at the time. You were a young boy at the time.
Yeah, at that time when my dad finally find that guy who dropped it and pay him back, I was so relieved and I was so happy that.
But your dad really didn't believe in magic, or at least he didn't act like it.
He didn't really like believe in it. He just wanted like to make me like feel good about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now your people also suffered greatly from diseases. Malaria almost killed your mother. There was cholera. There was AIDS. That must really lead to a high mortality rate among your people.
Yeah, the mortality rate is still high, but recently there have been like the government are doing all kind of programs to make sure that they are trying to reduce the mortality rate. Make sure that people sleep in the mosquito net every night so that we can at least reduce the number of malaria. Because
so if you don't sleep under the mosquito net, you're going to get bitten by the mosquito, and chances are you're going to get malaria. In fact, you write like it was pretty common.
Yeah. So if you don't sleep in the mosquito, that's probably like you have like high chance of getting malaria. It's really bad, especially for young people like kids. they are at real, like, a high risk, and also for pregnant women, they're also like in high level of like getting malaria.
And then there's cholera, and you write that people that came down with that had to be, when they died, you soaked the bodies in chlorine and buried them at night?
So with the cholera outbreak, you need like to bury the body as soon as possible so that it doesn't get like transmitted to other people. So during that time, it was real bad. They had to do, you had like to make sure that you are controlling the spread of the cholera. So like providing chlorine to people so they can add in their drinking water,
yeah,
and things like that.
So, and you write that parents in your country would name their children not based on their hopes for them, but on their greatest fears for them.
Yeah, it's pretty much common. You hear like parents who call their kids the names that have like some because of like some circumstances that the parents had like to go through,
mm-hmm,
or tragic.
Give me some of those names.
So it's like a great fear if a parent loses their like kids, like their kids dies, like two or three kids died in a row, and then they, once they have like a new baby, they say like Marizani, which means like finishing them all. It's like just
finish
like,
them all.
Yeah, it's like just like this anger that I'm having babies, they're just like dying. What's happening? What's wrong with me? So it's like, oh, because you like taking my kids away or killing my kids away, just finishing them all. So it's kind of like naming the kids
after the fear and hopes that the fear won't happen.
Won't happen. Yeah,
I see.
So
I
that's
see.
Yeah.
Now, there was a political upheaval in your country too when you were a boy. The powerful man ruled your world. Hastings Kamutsu Banda. Am I pronouncing his name right?
Hastings Kamutsu Banda. Yeah, he ruled Malawi for 31 years.
And you wrote that he was cruel and oppressive, but he understood farmers.
Yeah, in terms of like farming, he was still like good about that, but in other areas, he was more of like oppressive, more of like a dictator.
And that was right after the British left?
Yeah.
And then Banda was replaced by Bakili Mulusi. Am I pronouncing that right?
Yeah.
And things took a turn for the worse. You write that there was a terrible famine and hunger that gripped the country, and he ignored it.
Yeah, during his term, Bakili Mulusi was more of like a business man. He didn't care that much in terms of like agriculture, which is the main source of income for many people, mm-hmm, in the country. So when there was a drought in 2001 to 2002 growing season, that's when there was like a famine, and then a lot of people were really like starving. But he, at the beginning, he ignored that, because most of the time when something like that happens, the government have like a grant that they do like sell out corn to people at a low price.
What I understood is that the crops failed, and then you had surplus grain, but the government sold it, so you no longer had the surplus grain during the famine.
Yeah, so the surplus grain were sold. Also, one other thing that happened is that during that time, the IMF...
the International Monetary Fund.
Yeah, they suggested that they should sell some of the corn because it was so expensive to keep them. But instead of like selling some of them, they sold all of it. So that's what made the situation a little hard.
Tell us how the famine affected your family and your friends. It was pretty awful, wasn't it?
It was bad situation. My family was badly affected by the situation. I had like, at that time I was supposed to start a high school. I had to stop, to drop out of high school because my parents couldn't pay for my education. All the money that they were founding, they were using it to buy
food, and food was very expensive because it was so scarce.
Yes.
So you were not only hungry, but you no longer had any money because it was all going to buy just a little bit of food to feed the family.
Yeah.
What happened to the price of maize?
In a short time of period, it tripled. The price like just go up. Like it was so expensive. Like you are buying, it's like you are buying like some expensive things. But most of people couldn't manage to afford, because what was happening was that some corn that they were selling at the market were coming from neighboring country Tanzania, so it was too expensive to transport it.
Yeah.
And also some vendors took advantage of the situation. They say, oh, it's this situation, and they were tripling the price.
And you wrote that some of the grain that was being sold was actually diluted or watered down with sawdust, so people were eating sawdust during that period.
So, yeah, what other people were doing, they were having like this, you know, sometimes people sell the corn husks. So,
yeah.
So they were mixing corn husks with like sawdust, because the form of corn husks, just like also like the color, they look the same as the sawdust. So they would be like mixing. Which
so
was,
they weren't even eating corn; they were eating the corn husks, which you normally wouldn't.
Wouldn't eat. You normally give it to livestock. You normally don't eat those. Yeah.
You write about a shipment or delivery of food, Admark. And that was in the village of Chamama. Am I pronouncing that right?
Yeah.
And you went and got caught in a riot of hungry, starving people. Tell us a little about that.
So the ADMAG, it's like one of the government organization that sells and also buy food, agriculture products in Malawi. So they had like, they send out like some, a truck of corn to sell at Chamama.
How many people were there trying to get this food?
There were a lot of people. There were like a long line, and my parents sent me to go buy it, and it was pretty much everyone. People were just like pushing each other, trying to get to
people were falling over, and they were stepping on them and stepping over them, and
yeah,
and you just barely got out of there.
I was just like lucky. I think maybe because I was small and short, I could like go through like through people mm-hmm. very easy comparing to some other people. So I was just like lucky that I just got it before things get real like waste.
You got your portion of food, and they cheated you a little bit on it.
Yeah.
But you got out of there before things got really bad.
But yeah.
Today on Route 51, a conversation with William Kamkwamba, the boy who harnessed the wind. In just a bit, we'll be talking to Colin Hansen, the Edgar Elementary School teacher who helped bring him to central Wisconsin, and to Romy Wagner, a Wausau alderman, manager of the community's business incubator, and a volunteer who's helping the Maasai people of Kenya build their own generator and wind-powered wells. But first, we'll have the second part of our interview with William Kamkwamba after this short break.
Support for WPR comes from Rely Local Wausau, building the local economy and strengthening the community by making local business everybody's business. More about locally owned and operated businesses at relylocal.com.
Clear and cold tonight across north central Wisconsin, down to 2 below 0. Friday, mostly sunny, a bit milder, a high of 32, a low of 15. Saturday, partly sunny, a high of 36, a low of 20. Sunday, mostly cloudy, a high of 34, a low of 18. Right now, we've got clear skies across north central Wisconsin, 21 degrees in Marshfield, 23 in Stevens Point, 25 in Eagle River, Land O'Lakes, and Mosinee, 30 in Wapaka, 28 in Tomahawk and Phillips, 27 degrees in Woodruff, Rhinelander, Antigo, Medford, and outside our studio in Wausau. I'm Glenn Mobrig, and today on Route 51, the story of William Kamkwamba, the boy who harnessed the wind. Joining us for the final part of our program will be Colin Hansen, the Edgar Elementary School teacher who played a big part in bringing Mr. Kamkwamba to central Wisconsin, and also Romy Wagner, a volunteer who's helping the Maasai people in Kenya build their own generator and windmill-powered wells. But first, the second part of our interview with William, as he tells us how he built his windmill.
The school that I started with like the primary school, which was just like next to my village. It was close. So it was that primary school, it was good, but we didn't have like enough facilities, and even the classrooms weren't enough.
And test scores came out, and your grades weren't that good.
Yeah, my grades weren't that good, so I was sent to, after finishing the primary school, I was sent to community day secondary school.
And even though your grades weren't good, and you had to drop out of school because there was no money to pay for the education, yet somehow you managed to educate yourself, and you did that by looking at library books and learning them yourself.
Yes, so when I dropped out of school, I wanted for myself, I wanted like to continue with my studies. I thought that education would be a key to everything that I want to do.
Key to a better life.
Yeah, key to a better life in the future. So I wanted to continue with my education. So when I dropped it, I decided to start like reading books at the library. I was hoping that when the hunger be over and my parents find money, they'll send me back to school. I shouldn't be very behind from everyone. So I wanted to keep up with my my studies. So I was going to the library, reading books, and also trying to understand what was happening. So,
and you write that you found an American textbook called Using Energy, and that changed your life.
Yes. So one day when I went to the library, I found this book called Using Energy, which had pictures of the windmill on the cover.
And big windmills.
Big windmills, yeah. When I opened inside, they say windmills could pump water and generate electricity.
And what would that have meant? What did that end up meaning for your home?
So for pump water, it meant irrigation for crops. I thought that if I can be able to build a windmill to pump water, then I'll be able to generate, I'll be able to pump water and start irrigation, growing food.
And that would give you an extra season of vegetables, right? So you'd have two crops in a year instead of just one.
Yeah.
And that might mean your family would double their income. And you wouldn't have to worry about famine quite as much anymore.
Yeah, that was the idea.
So you decided to build your own windmill with no parts, no experience, no formal training. You dropped out of school. You're a young man living in this small village in the backcountry of Africa. And you built it out of old parts that you salvaged from a junkyard. Tell me about that.
So when I decided like to build one windmill for myself, I didn't have like money. So I had to go to the junkyard, which was also just like next to the high school that I just dropped from. So when I was going there collecting all my parts, people were laughing at me. Some people were thinking that maybe I'm going crazy. Some were like maybe I'm smoking weed.
So
but for me, I didn't stop doing what I wanted to do. So I collected all the pieces of material, like putting them together.
And you dug PVC pipe, plastic pipe, out of the ground? And there was a bicycle that you converted, or at least parts of it. It was your dad's bicycle, your father's bicycle.
Yeah, so I finally tried to convince my dad to ask him to give me his bike. He was willing to give me his bike, and I used the frame of the bike for the windmill to make the windmill.
So, and then the wheel you used too.
Yeah, so I used like the same system, the same like everything as the bike works with like the bicycle dynamo to generate power.
And you talked to yourself about the difference between alternating current and direct current, and how dynamos work, and electromagnetic induction, and all of this stuff. You taught yourself.
Yeah, so most of those stuff, yeah, I taught myself by just looking some diagrams in the book that I was also like getting at the school. So I would look at the diagrams and try to learn the words around it. That's basically how I was doing it.
You didn't even have a lot of your own tools. You had to make your own drill.
Yeah.
You didn't have nuts or bolts until your friend bought you a bag of them. What made you think that you could do this?
So one thing that made me that I can do it is that I just looked at it and somebody has already built a windmill somewhere else. So I was like, this is not like a new invention. This is not like a new technology. It's a technology that existed. If a human being did it, there's nothing that can stop me from doing the same thing. I think that really like encouraged me to do what I did.
How did you make the stand for the windmill? What was that made out of?
So for the stand of the windmill, I made out of wood.
You had to cut down trees?
Yeah, I had to cut down three trees that I used as the poles. And then
you formed like a tripod.
Tripod.
With three trees.
Mm-hmm.
And you built that next to your house, and then you attached the rotating part of the windmill to the stand. Tell us about the day that you got the windmill going.
So the day that the windmill started like working, that was one of my one of the exciting day of my life, because I've been like working on that project for quite a long time and people were laughing at me. So it was, for me, it was not only like the success that the windmill was working, but also trying also like to prove to people that what I was doing, mm-hmm. it wasn't only like craziness, that the way they fought. So I think I was real happy, and a lot of people like came by to see what was going on.
They were looking up at you and waiting to see whether you could actually make this work. And I bet a lot of them thought they were going to be laughing at you because you were going to fail.
Yeah.
And you didn't fail.
So it worked. So when it worked,
And the light went on. You had a light bulb up there that you were able to generate the power for?
Yeah. So the light went on, and then I was so happy.
How did having electric lights change your life at home?
Having the electric lights changed my life a lot, because before we had the electricity, we used to use a kerosene lamp, mm-hmm. which was causing like smoke sometimes, and then the smoke would cause like cough thing. So
and the kerosene is expensive. You have to buy it.
Yeah, you have to buy it. So the money that my parents were spending to buy a kerosene, they started like using it for other use or buying some other stuff.
And suddenly you no longer had to go to bed at 7 at night.
Mm-hmm. I can still stay up late doing some readings. So that was like lots of change.
You write that the weather turned bad at one point, and some of the people in the village thought you were a witch and the windmill was keeping the rain away.
Yeah. So there was this this one year when they... when my windmill was working. So what was happening was that there would be like crowds forming, like lots of crowds, like rain crowds. It would be looking like it would start raining any time. So suddenly the wind would start like blowing so hardly. So because the wind is blowing so hard and my windmill would be speeding so fast, so the wind was blowing away also the crowds.
So they thought your windmill was blowing away the crowds.
So they say like, no, this is the magic. You are chasing away the rain. And they started like pointing a finger at my windmill.
William, with your passion for science, all self-taught, how do you convince ignorant people that they shouldn't believe in magic?
For me, it's because for magic, you can't still have like explanation how things are happening. I think that's one thing that bothers me about it, because there's no like explanation. While with the science, you can have like some real like explanation how it's happening, and somebody can be able to sit down and explain to you if you don't get it, but at least there's like some explanation that lives on behind it. But with magic, I think sometimes it's real hard like to explain what exactly happened.
Right.
And so that's why.
Now, in 2006, some teachers were visiting your village, and they noticed the windmill. And the next thing you know, the word got out. And you're a celebrity. You're a star. You're being interviewed by radio journalists, people that you listen to on the radio, newspapers. What did that feel like?
So it was a real, like, exciting experience, because those are the people that I just hear them on the radio speaking, so to be interviewed by them, it was great. The most important is that when they interviewed me, it's kind of like it also helped me with the people that were like thinking that the windmill that I built was chasing away the wind. When they saw, like,
it gave you credibility with the people in the village.
In the village, that if other people from town are coming to the village to interview me about my windmill, I think it must be something that is legible. So that's what gave me the...
Yeah, it's legitimate. It's not magic. It's science.
It's science.
Real.
Yeah.
And then there was this conference, the Technology, Entertainment, and Design Conference, the TED conference or TED conference?
Yeah, TED conference.
So, and you got to go to New York City.
So
how did you feel looking at New York City for the first time after coming from the backcountry in Africa?
So I went to the TED conference, which was held in Arusha, Tanzania. Then I met mm-hmm. with some friends, and then they invited me over to New York. It was so amazing, and it was so exciting. I came in December. The day that I came, it was the coldest day of the year in that year.
How were you dressed?
I wasn't ready for it. So normally in Malawi, when it is cold, you can just wear a T-shirt and wear a long sleeve shirt on top of it, you'll be fine. So I was dressing up like that. And
how do you like our weather in Wisconsin? It's 20 degrees out today, strong wind.
It's tough. So yeah. So when I was at the airport, I was inside the airport. So I didn't know that they have heaters, because most of the houses in Malawi, they don't have heaters. So when it's cold outside, it's also cold inside.
Right.
So I was like, and these people are just lying. This is not cold. This is warm.
Uh-huh.
I didn't know that they were using heaters. I went outside. I was so freezing. I was like, this is another level of cold.
But then to look at the traffic and the multi-lane highways and the buildings and the construction, and all the people running around talking on their cell phones.
That was so fascinating that before I visited New York, the highest point that I have been was on the top of my windmill.
Uh-huh.
Apart from like when I was traveling in the plane, of course that is the highest, but being on the ground, like the highest point was the top of my windmill. So just like seeing some skyscrapers, I was like, wow, this is
amazing.
Did
you go up on the Empire State Building or you did go up there? Yeah.
I did go up there.
Are you afraid of heights?
No, I'm not really. I'm not afraid of heights.
Good for you.
Yeah.
and then suddenly, venture capitalists, people like John Doerr and John Gage of Sun Microsystems and Jay Walker, the founder of Priceline, suddenly they're investing in you and your ideas. Wow.
Yeah, so they really like helped me, like going back to school, and also supported me in some of the projects that I was working on in my village.
And you went to see a windmill farm in California.
Yes.
What did you think of that?
I was so impressed. It was amazing. Like seeing one of the farms that I visited, it generated more power than one of the great power provider in Malawi generated. So mm-hmm. it's like with that wind farm, it can completely like power the whole nation. So I was so excited that this is like, it's really like possible to power the country like Malawi with wind energy.
You write that you want to create a new kind of Africa, a place of leaders instead of victims, a home of innovation rather than charity. Expound on that.
So I find out that there's like so many talented young people in many countries in Africa, but the problem that sometimes they don't come to fully use their talent, their knowledge. We are not like maximizing those like potential, like to promote and also like motivate young people to realize their dreams, to come up with their dreams, to try to find solution towards the problem that they are facing by themselves, instead of like creating a solution mm-hmm. to them. I think that would be the best way. You can still support them with like financial support or some technical support, but I feel that the system should start with themselves like coming up with some solution towards the problem that they are facing.
You think that's going to happen?
Probably it will happen.
You think you're going to play a part of it?
I'll try my best to be part of it.
And you sum up everything with one important lesson you learned. If you want to make it, all you have to do is try.
Yeah. If you don't try, then there's no way that maybe you would have made it. But if you try, if you won't make it, it's okay. But if you try and you made it, then you have made what you want to do. But if you don't try,
If you don't try, you'll never see what you might have been able to do.
Yeah.
And persistence is so important, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Don't give up.
Don't give up. Everything is possible.
William Kamkwamba, thank you so much for being with us today. It's wonderful to have you here, and thanks for sharing your story.
Thank you.
William Kamkwamba, the boy who harnessed the wind. When we come back, we'll be talking to Colin Hansen, the Edgar Elementary school teacher who helped bring him here, and Romy Wagner, a Wausau man who's been working with the Maasai people of Kenya, helping them to build their own generator and windmill-powered wells. Well, not real good weather for gardening. Clear and cold tonight with a low of 2 below zero Friday. Mostly sunny, a bit milder, a high of 32. Saturday, partly sunny, a high of 36. Sunday, mostly cloudy, a high of 34. And we have 27 degrees right now outside our studio in Wausau. I'm Glenn Mobrick. Today, we've been featuring the story of William Kamkwamba, the boy who harnessed the wind. Joining us for the final part of our program, we've got Colin Hansen, the Edgar Elementary school teacher, who played a big part in bringing Mr. Kamkwamba to Central Wisconsin through the Walk in Their Shoes program, and Romy Wagner, who's a number of things. He's a Wausau alderman, the manager of the community's business incubator, and also a volunteer who's helping the Maasai people of Kenya build their own wells. Let's start with you, Colin. Who did William Kamkwamba share his story with this week?
It was a great week. Tuesday night, he spoke to the Wausau community at Wausau East Auditorium, and then our program features about 8 different school districts, both public and private. So Wednesday morning and then Wednesday afternoon, those schools, about 1,700 kids heard his program, and then last night and this morning, he was down in Stevens Point.
How did the school kids react?
A lot of them. I've gotten some emails back from teachers, and they were just very excited when they got back to start journaling and writing. And I even had one teacher request some contact information because students wanted to personally send an email or personally write a letter to William.
Now this Walk in Their Shoes program involves a lot of people. John Noel is active in it down in Stevens Point, correct?
Yes, he helped sponsored this year and stuff, and he also gave us a lot of contacts in the Stevens Point area, which helped make that connection to bring our program from Wausau to Stevens Point.
Well, how does this work? How does a walk in their shoes work?
Well, there's 8 people total in the group, and again, we are a team. There's different teachers from the Wausau School District, DC Everest, and then myself, from Edgar School District, and we work together. We start every year after our program, we'll have another meeting in May, and we'll throw some books on the table, and we'll make decisions on what we think not only will attract sponsors and community members, but will also fit in the curriculums for our 7th and 8th graders.
And we've had a number of these people as guests on this show, the Tuskegee Airmen, one of my favorite shows ever. We had Luong Ung, who had just a heartrending story of growing up in the genocide in Southeast Asia.
Yeah.
So pretty amazing, the kinds of people you've been able to get into Central Wisconsin.
That, and then, you know, for the past 6 years, we've been very fortunate to not only have the support of teachers that work with the students prior to the programs, the administration, and then also, too, it doesn't happen without our community sponsors.
If you, those of you listening in Radio Land, which is something I'm not supposed to say, if you'd like to weigh in on William's story. If you listen to this incredible story of him growing up in the backcountry of Africa, building his own windmill, helping out his village, 1-800-780-9742, 1-800-780-9742. We'll try to squeeze in a couple of phone calls. Romy, as somebody who's worked bringing water to the Maasai people, your impressions of William's story?
I think it's an amazing story. He's an amazing person. To think he did this, his vision, he acted on things at the young age of 12 to 14 years old. Truly an inspiration. And learning more about Colin and the program that he's working with to bring the people here, that really is the education side that we have
right
to bring to the young people. I'm so impressed with the program and with the story.
You know, and if you're an educator, you've got to love his story. Look at all the stuff he was dealing with. Working, you know, day in and day out on this farm. No electricity, no running water, disease, and then this famine. And somehow, and he couldn't go to school. He had to drop out of school because his parents didn't have the money to send him to school. And he decides to teach himself about alternating and direct current and electromagnetic induction and then build a windmill without tools. How many kids in America would be able to meet a challenge like that?
For him to walk through a junkyard and see something that he visions will work for one of his switches or for a piece that he's yet to develop to create is an amazing mind. Fantastic.
You know, and he had to talk his dad into giving up his bicycle so he could, his precious bicycle, so he could tear that apart and use the wheel for the spinning part of the windmill and the frame for another part.
I think also another component to the story is the fact that, you know, in our society, sometimes we go into that peer pressure mode of we're going to follow and not be a leader, whereas he was the leader and he really blocked out that cultural side of it where kids were making fun of him, adults were making fun of him and calling him crazy and mad, but yet he stayed his course because he had that vision.
And he was rummaging through the junkyard right across the street from the school that he wasn't admitted to, and the kids were making fun of him, like you said, and it did not dissuade him.
Yeah, and even for his mom to say, because she thought he was going to be crazy, that he might not ever find a wife, and he still, you know, laughs at that story and stayed the course to continue to do the work.
For him to come back to his village and, as you said, put solar panels on the school that wouldn't let him in is a true lesson for everyone to realize not to hold grudges.
Turn the other cheek.
Turn the other cheek. That's an amazing part of him that it just truly inspires me.
But Romy, tell us about the work you've been doing in Kenya. You've been at it for 10 years now with another local volunteer, your friend Don Ryder.
That's correct. And after spending some time in Kenya on some humanitarian work 10, 12 years ago, we decided that why should we be like other Americans and come back? And we decided, if not us, who will make a difference? So we started raising some money, formed a foundation through the Community Foundation, and we're on our third water project now. The first one started out in the middle of nowhere, as they said, on the edge of nowhere, and drilled a well, bought a diesel engine to run the electric pump to pump the water, and found out the people that were living in these conditions were afraid of their own reflections because they had never seen clean water. They were afraid of the clean water because they never drank it before.
You brought some pictures with you of the Maasai people, and I dare say the conditions they're living in are even more primitive than the ones that William Kamkwamba was living in.
It was amazing that what really tugged at our hearts were the women and the girls would walk every 3 days up to 18, 19 kilometers one way to fill jugs full of dirty water that dead animals were floating in. That infant mortality rates at 2 weeks were over 50%. We went to furnish water to the Maasai, and they did all the work, and we thought we were done, but then we were shown 35 kilometers farther down the road where our second project started, and we reconditioned a windmill that the government had promised and given up on. And the locals spent 2 years dismantling a 200,000-gallon tank, stone tank, and moving it by burrows 7 or 8 kilometers and rebuilding it on a hill so that we pumped water into that tank and then gravity-fed it down to a school and to a dispensary that now the government has turned into an 8-bedroom hospital because it has clean water.
Kamkwamba spoke about tribal superstition and a belief in magic, which discouraged people from learning about science and applying those concepts to better their own lives. Did you encounter that with the Maasai?
We really didn't have any kind of voodoo or magic or anything. They were truly herders. They were nomadic. They lived off the blood and milk of their animals and killed a goat every once in a while.
Explain that blood and milk of their animals.
Part of their herd, they had milkers and bleeders, where they'd actually mark and rotate the cattle that were to be bled. They'd put a reed up into the vein in the neck and drain blood into a gourd, and they'd mix it with milk, and that combination is what they lived on. They could carry that around for 3, 4, 5 days.
It doesn't sound exactly kosher to me, but still, it's something that would help them survive.
And as they say, you could live on it, but it didn't necessarily taste any good. Every once in a while, they'd kill a goat and eat that. But along with our wells, we taught them drip irrigation farming, and we're real happy that, just proud of the fact that there's an acre and a half of cabbage and beans and mm-hmm. corn being irrigated at our first well.
Any trees in the area where the Maasai live?
There are acacia trees that every once in a while, but it's the Masai Mara is the wide open plains that there's grass on it during the rainy season, and there's dust on it the rest of the year.
And there are wild animals that these people have to contend with.
That's a good point. They live in what is referred to as bomas, which are circular shapes of mud and dung houses that are right tight together that they put their cattle and themselves in every night to keep the lions and the wildebeest and things out at night. They control after dark.
Wow.
Well, one of the things that we're very proud of the fact that we now furnish clean water to over 65,000 humans a day just from two old guys in Wausau that started something 10, 12 years ago.
How did you get into this? How did you two feel that you could actually do this?
It's a long story, but we'd been going to Jamaica with the Helping Hands group out of St. Matt's Church for years, going up on the mountains of the poorest of the poor, and there was an African priest by the name of Father Peter Gatumbo that mm-hmm. started working on us, and we didn't even know it, that we'd drink the juice that they fermented, and at one point we agreed to go to Africa.
Did that fermented juice have anything to do with it?
I think it really did, and being the people that once we promised to do it, a group of us went over to help his tribe, his elders, finish a church. And then we went on a safari, and Don and I had never met each other before, which is comical in itself, and we found out we have similar backgrounds. We both come from families of 13 kids. We're the third oldest of each one. Don and I actually got married on the same day, him 10 years before me, all the different things that we did. And
you're from Edgar,
where
Colin Hansen
yes.
is from.
I had a tell Colin that my picture is on the wall of fame in Edgar at the high school. I'm proud of that. But then when we came back, we had met Maasai and we had heard the stories.
How easy or how difficult was it to be accepted by them?
The language was a big barrier. And once they didn't believe what we were doing, they had never seen a drilling apparatus. They didn't know we were drilling for water. Water came either from the sky, down the mountain in the floods, or from the dirty puddles. They didn't know you could get water. They didn't know what it was. And once we got the first water out, we were treated like kings.
You know, in the last page of William Kamkwamba's book, he writes that he dreams of creating a new kind of Africa, a place of leaders instead of victims, a home of innovation rather than charity. And when I read that quote back to him, he said that although they can be encouraged by the outside world, he said we have to rely on the local people of Africa to come up with their own ideas and the solutions to their own problems.
Truly what drives Don and I is that we go into Africa, to Kenya, to give them the opportunity to be better Kenyans. We are very careful not to try to Americanize them. We're trying to learn their language, and they do the work. They get the ownership, and they're very proud of it then.
And William Kamkwamba's simple message, if you want to make it, all you have to do is try.
Wonderful.
You can get it if you really want. You can get it if you really want.
We want to thank today's guests, Edgar Elementary School teacher Colin Hansen, Romy Wagner, Wausau City Alderman, and a volunteer helping the Maasai tribe in Kenya. And also a very special thanks to William Kumkwamba, best-selling author of the autobiography, The Boy Who Harvested the Wind. That book is published by William Morrow HarperCollins. And you can find out more about his story at the website movingwindmills.org. You can find out more about the program that brought him to Central Wisconsin at the website awalkintheirshoes.net. I'm Glenn Moberg of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks to our executive producer, Rick Ryer, and our on-air producer, Jane Ritger. Special music today by Bob Dylan and Jimmy Cliff. Thanks for riding along with us today. Forward, as we say in Wisconsin, and until next week, we are heading out of town.
Opposition will come your way. The hotter the battle you see, it's the sweeter the victory. Now you can get it if you really want. You can get it if you really want. You can get it if you really want. But you must try, try and try, try and try. You'll succeed at last.